We have Jim speaking tonight. He has 43 years of sobriety. He's going to have 44 in another month. Jim was originally from New Jersey, although he got sober in Visalia. And I could say more, but we're going to leave it at that. So let's give a warm Valley Group welcome to Jim.
Woo! I'm Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know why, that I usually don't have trouble talking at meetings, but this is, you know, I'm 83 years old. I've got 43 years sobriety, 44 in another month. And that's just a lot to squeeze into 45 minutes. And it just gets harder every year because it's just more time. But, you know, I have come to the conclusion. I grew up in an upper middle class family of very well educated, very polite people. I was sandwiched between two sisters who got straight A's in school, and I was a little fucko. Excuse my language. But I did a lot of odd things. I'm sure my parents didn't understand why I was doing them. And I used to be specific about these when I introduced myself and my journey into alcoholism. But to tell you the truth, I've come to the conclusion recently that they may not have had that very much to do with my alcohol, you know, with what happened to me later on when I began to drink. By high school, I had pretty much addressed many of those problems on my own. I wasn't drinking yet. I didn't start drinking till I was a junior in college. So I'm not sure that had any real effect on me in the way I drank. I think what had the major effect was I think I was born with this disease. I don't know how to say that, but the disease, as I got some insight after I first got sober into that. It's a threefold disease, and allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind and a spiritual malady. And that's the way it's described in the book. And, you know, I had no interest in drinking. My parents occasionally, maybe once or twice or three times a month, would have a cocktail or two before dinner. And the only other time I knew that they were drinking anything was on a neighbor used to throw a Christmas party every year about 2 weeks or a week before Christmas. And they'd always had two bowls of punch, one for the adults and one for the children. And so the adults, and I not knowing it then, but now I know that the one for the adults had booze in it. But I had three cousins that used to come around on Christmas Eve, and they'd be half smashed, and I always thought they were having a lot of fun. They were laughing and joking and carrying on, and my parents, I learned later, hated to see them come on Christmas Eve, but they showed up without fault. And so that was the only time I saw anybody half smashed. The drinking age in New Jersey back then was 21. There wasn't really much drinking in our high school. I don't even know where there were liquor stores. And, you know, I went out for football and hung around with the jocks and weightlifted back then. And we had a Y where everybody hung out, but, you know, I know a couple of guys would come in with hangovers occasionally, and I do remember in my senior year a bunch of guys, somebody, when they had their own car at that time, about six guys jumped in and they took off before school started, and they came back when school was out. And in New York, state, in New York City, you could drink at the age of 18, so they had driven 40 miles north into New York state, guys stayed, spent all day drinking and came back after school. But, you know, even back then, I really liked jazz, and Lionel Hampton was playing in a jazz club in New York City, and I wanted to go in to see him, so I talked about eight of my friends into going into the city with me to this jazz club to see Lionel Hampton play, and they all got served drinks, and I ordered milk, you know, and they charged drinks, mixed drinks for 85 cents a drink back then, and they charged me 85 cents for a glass of milk. They said I could drink milk as long as I pay the same as I paid for a mixed drink. So, you know, I really had no interest in drinking. I went off to college and at all men's engineering school. It was Lehigh University in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And all the guys there drank, except me, some more than others. And they used to have a fall and a spring 3-day weekend, and women for up and down the coast of the eastern coast of the United States would come to this big party that the school sponsored twice a year, once in the fall and one in the springtime. And I just had never seen so many drunk people in my life, and I just thought it was funny. I didn't participate in the drinking and have any inclination to. I just enjoyed watching them make fools of themselves. And I lasted one semester at Lehigh and transferred. My parents had, my dad had been transferred to a business down in Memphis as soon as I graduated from high school. And so I transferred to the University of Mississippi, which was about 100 some miles away from Memphis, and started school there. And Mississippi was, back then, the South was dry. All you could get in a wet county was a 3.2 beer. You couldn't buy hard liquor in clubs or anything, and you couldn't carry it in a dry county. So there wasn't any drinking to speak of on the University of Mississippi campus because they were in a dry county. So I didn't see any drinking there. And I discovered that I was there a year and a half and then transferred back to a Presbyterian liberal arts college in Memphis, and lived in back. I was back living at home for my junior and senior year, and I think part of it was that I'd gotten kind of lonely because I just couldn't make friends. I made some friends each place, but they weren't the kind of friends that, you know, were going to stick. And I think I just got lonely, and I didn't know. Here I was in my third new college with no friends again. And when I was between my freshman and sophomore year in college, when I was at Lehigh, I was still wrestling with some of my psychological problems from childhood, and a friend of mine at Lehigh invited me to go to a revival service at a Brethren church in downtown Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And I went to the revival meeting, and they had an altar call at the end of the revival meeting where you gave your life to God. And I made the altar call, and something did change in me that day. And so when I was at the University of Mississippi, I latched on to a girl who was trying to start up a Bible study group, and I didn't really know that much about the Bible, but I started it up with her, and occasionally we'd have two or three people that came each week. And she arranged for me to go to the first summer between my freshman and sophomore year to work in a camp in the Colorado Rockies, which was staffed by Youth for Christ workers, and I mean kids from college. And you know, I argued with my dad. He wanted me to work, and finally, after 2 months, he gave in and gave me $40 and said, "If you can get there on $40, you can go." And $40 was a one-way ticket on the train to Colorado Springs. And I went there not knowing who was going to meet me or anything. I didn't have a name, or they just somebody told me somebody'd meet me at. In Colorado Springs, a little cow town then, and nobody met me, so I went in a barber shop, and this lady pops her head in the door and says, "Are you Jim King?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, come with me." We drove about 25 miles back into the Colorado Rockies to this camp. And the reason I say this is the camp was rented out to church groups, and somewhere they got ministers that were there on Wednesday nights to talk to the kids that worked in the camp. There's like a meeting, a church meeting for an hour and a half. And the one minister they had speaking one night spent the whole hour and a half talking about how Jesus led them to believe that drinking was okay. And he explained to us that his rationale was that by being able to go down to the corner bar and have a couple of beers with the boys, he could save those poor souls for Jesus. And I can remember thinking, what a concept. So when I got home from that summer, I went and talked to my pastor about it, Presbyterian pastor, and told him the whole spiel. And when I got through, he says, "Well, you know, I tried to work with too many alcoholics with too little success to recommend that you start drinking if you're not now drinking." I left his office thinking he didn't understand what I was trying to say. And I hadn't had a drink yet. And then I wrote the girl that sent me there a letter and told her about it. And she wrote me back, and it was a 6-page letter, but the only thing I can remember from it, as she said in her letter, "I know if you've made a decision to do this, there's nothing I can do to stop you." And, you know, I didn't understand that. Looking back, I assumed that she must have had some alcoholics in her family or something, because she was trying to send me a message. And I just thought, she doesn't know what she's talking about. Well, you know, that was in my sophomore year, and when I switched to my third college, I don't know, I must have just... There was a guy at campus that transferred in his junior year, too, from another college, and he was the kind of a guy I always wanted to be like. He just had everything I thought I wanted, and I thought, I'm going to get to know him because I don't want to know what he's got. And he drank some, and it was somewhere in there with him in my junior year that I started drinking with him. I think it was just beers. And we decided that a good place to... They had 6 small fraternities on campus, and we decided the good place to drink would be at the fraternity. So we, during... whatever a week they call it when you go and visit all the fraternities, we found the one where they drank the most and pledged with them, and they made us the president and vice president of the next pledge class. And so now, you know, as soon as I started drinking, I drank alcoholically. And, you know, the whole point of this story is the fact that I think I was born with a disease, and all it took was to set the disease in action was to drink. And then, you know, it was like, I like to use the freeze-dried coffee thing. You know, I was a jar of freeze-dried coffee. I wasn't a cup of coffee until somebody added the water to it. And then it became a full-grown cup of coffee. But, you know, I was a freeze-dried alcoholic, and as soon as I added alcohol to my system, I became a full-blown alcoholic. I didn't social drink my way into this disease. When I started drinking, I just wanted to drink until I drank as much as I wanted to drink. And a lot of times, it was just until I passed out at night, you know. And The odd thing is, I was thinking about that, and I remembered about a year and a half before, I had had a drink. I used to hitchhike between Memphis and Ole Miss on the weekends, and my parents had let me take the car back to the campus for 1 week, and I picked up a hitchhiker as a kid, because I knew what it was like to try to hitchhike, and I was going out of Memphis and picked him up, and he had a bottle of some kind of whiskey with him. I don't know what it was, but he had just been let out of jail, and he was trying to get home, and he was celebrating. He insisted that I take a drink. So finally, to shut him up, I just took a swallow of that whiskey, and the stuff was so bad that I tried to say something, and I couldn't talk. But I don't remember it making me want to drink anymore. I don't remember that. So that was my first drink. But anyway, once I started drinking, I just became a full-blown alcoholic, and I drank alcoholically for the next 20 years, mostly at night. You know, when I started working, I had to work to support a family. I married a girlfriend that I'd had for a year or so in the summer between my junior and senior year, and my parents helped us out. And she worked for a while. When I graduated from college, I joined the Air Force because you couldn't get a decent job unless you were draft free. And so I wanted to get my service commitment out of the way so I could start a career. And so in the next 20 years of drinking, I built a career, and I was pretty successful at it. I did quit on my own once about 11 years into my marriage. That marriage wasn't working very well, and my wife never seemed to be very happy with me, and she never complained about my drinking, but I decided we had just gotten a new job in Niles, Michigan. We were living in New Jersey, and I decided before we left for Niles, Michigan, that perhaps I was the problem in our marriage. Maybe my drinking was what, you know, made her the way she was, and I decided to quit drinking to see if that would make any difference in our marriage. So I didn't want her to tell her I was going to do that in case I failed. I didn't want her to, you know, see me as a failure. So I made a decision to stop drinking to see if that would affect our marriage. And it was the hardest thing I'd done for the 6 months. First 6 months, I got a stiff neck from controlling myself all the time. But the thing is, I did some things right. I started back to church. I taught a Sunday school class. I coached little league ball. I did some other civic-minded things. I taught an art class to sixth graders, and you know, I got involved with the community. And my mother-in-law came to visit us once, and she made the remark after being there a few days. She said, "I don't know what's happened to you, Jim." He said, "You just turned into the nicest guy." But my wife never said anything. She didn't. She never even ended. There was only one time when I thought maybe she'd noticed that I'd stopped drinking. She loved to play bridge, and we had bridge parties on the weekend, and I just thought, I want to see if she notices. So I went in the kitchen and got a martini glass, filled it with water, and put an olive in it. And I went back and sat it on the table like I'd made myself a martini. And her eyes got as big as quarters. And I thought, okay, she's noticed. But after about a year and a half, I got so lonely. I didn't have any male friends anymore because All the guys who were my friends used to drink to one degree or another, and that's what they did when they got together, and I stopped getting invited places because I didn't drink anymore. So I got to Dan Mullen, and she wasn't, my wife wasn't any friendlier with me, so. So I just said to hell with it, I'd rather have friends, and I started drinking again, and I got friends again, and I drank that way until I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Except my best effort at the end of my drinking lasted for 3 hours. I couldn't do any more than 3 hours on my own. I mean, I didn't drink during the day because I had a job and I couldn't drink during at work. And then I knew if I drank at lunch, I probably wasn't going to get back to work, and I didn't want to get fired. So I drank excessively at night, drank myself to sleep every night. Usually got to be by myself, and things got pretty dark and grim. And I'd been living on and off with this alcoholic addict girl I met in a bar. And, at one point I was paying my first wife alimony and child support. I'd rented this house where this girl I'd met in the bar, Shelby, and I were going to live happily ever after, and that didn't work out. So I had a year's lease on the house, and I was paying the lease on this house she was living in, and I had rented a little dingy apartment, so I was like supporting three households at one point. I had no money left and drinking myself into a stupor, and there's a whole story associated with that. But anyway, she finally came back to live with me, and I was just miserable. And one Saturday I was laying on the bed in the bedroom, and she just came in and looked at me and said, "Jimmy, you're going to turn into a derelict and a lonely old man." And for some reason, that just cut right to my heart. And then a week later, I was in the same condition, on the same bed, at the same time. And she came in, and she was not religious at all, but she just said, "Jimmy, I pray to Jesus that you quit drinking," and walked out. And a week later, I had this knowing moment where this voice said, "You never get sober living here." And I got up. It was 6 a.m. I got up and I said, "I have to leave." She didn't object, and I moved into the Oak Tree Inn in the back with the rest of the alcoholics. And that's where I was when I got sober. But this guy in the shop, Jack, he was older than me, but he'd been coming in once a month to my office at work and telling me all about how he's getting sober in AA. And I knew what AA was. I'd known through books and movies and magazine articles and stuff that that's where you went when you just had no other alternatives. And, so this voice that last night just said, "Well, Go find," this voice told me what to do, and it said very clearly, "Go get Jack tomorrow morning, take him out for a cup of coffee, and tell him that you can't stop drinking and you need help." And that's exactly what I did the next day, and he took me to my first 3 AA meetings. Anyway, AA got me turned around and headed in the right direction. This is a miraculous program. I was just, some statistics came up in my mind from my early sobriety. If you're new here, you're new to AA, or even if you're not new, or you're thinking about coming to AA, these were statistics from the National Council on Alcoholism, and one of them I think came from, it was in the AA grapevine or something. But, 10 to 12% of the population of the United States is alcoholic. The rest are normal drinkers. And one out of 36 of those alcoholics will get sober. And 3% will get sober through the church, and 97% of them will probably get sober through AA. And if you converted that to Visalia, that would mean that Visalia has 140,000 people at this point in time, and that would mean that there's about 14,000 alcoholics in Visalia, and only 390 to 460 of those alcoholics will get sober. And if you go around to all the AA meetings and count up all the people, that's probably pretty close to right. Now, if you're here tonight, you're now, if you haven't had a drink today, you're one of the 36 alcoholics who's now sober. The other 35 are still drunk. So, it's just, you're lucky, is my point. I was very fortunate to find AA. I was very fortunate that God gave me the grace to listen, to stay around long enough to find out what the answer was. It was, you know, I was like Alice in Wonderland for the first 3 months. I was living in the stumpy motel room. I still had the same job. I was hitchhiking to work. I didn't have a car. I was hitchhiking to work with people that work under me. I had borrowed my son's 10-speed bike. And I, was that's what got me. There weren't any morning AA meetings, and there weren't any noon AA meetings at that time. All the meetings were from 8 o'clock to 9:30 at night, and there were only 5 a week. The other 2 nights you had to go to Tulare on Thursday night and Sunday night if you wanted a meeting. I was sometimes getting rides from some people in AA, but most of the time in Visalia I was riding that 10-speed bike to meetings for 3 months before I got sober enough to trust myself with buying a car. And, I didn't know exactly how sitting around meetings in AA was going to get me sober. I didn't know what sitting around a bunch of people was, how that was going to keep me from drinking. But for some magical reason, I didn't drink. The first 2 weeks, I'd come home from work at 5. I'd get on my bed and lay there till meeting time because I didn't want to drink. I didn't want to go out and drink. And after 2 weeks of that, I thought, I can't live like this. So I started to look for things to do between 5 and 8 o'clock at night besides eat dinner. You know, and I started picking up some hobbies. I won't go into them all, but I got so that I'd work on those hobbies between the time I got home and the time it was time to go to a meeting. And I thought the program was all the sayings that you hear in AA, and I'd get home from a meeting and I'd write down a new saying I heard. And then at one point I typed up a list. I think I had a list of like 12 AA sayings, and I thought that was the program of recovery. And I had it taped to my motel room wall, and I thought, what if I got upset or anxious or angry at something, I should go and over to that list and pick out one of the saying that was appropriate. I thought that's what the program of recovery was. But my sponsor and I got in an argument about 4 months sober, and he was yelling at me, and he was pounding on the big book, and fortunately, I just shut up, and I walked over and I said, let me see that. And he was pointing to the fourth step. He said, you're not doing it the way it says to do it here. And I thought, oh my gosh. So I went, it took me 3 months to get around and reading the big book. I had it in my motel room. I had it since my first or second or third meeting. You know, everybody said, buy a big book. So I did. Nobody said, read it. So it sat in my motel room for 3 months. And one Saturday morning, I was standing there wondering what I was going to do with that Saturday. And I looked over at the big book, and my mind said, I think I probably should read that. So that Saturday, nobody said buy a big book and read it. So I sat down that Saturday morning and read the first 164 pages. And then when Clyde was pounding on the big book, I went back and I reread the steps from the beginning. And by golly, he was right. I wasn't doing what the steps said to do. So I started to work my way methodically through the steps, doing each one. You know, I'd read it first in the big book and then read it in the 12 by 12. And then I'd do whatever it told me to do. And I did as thorough a job as I could at that. It took me about 3 months to get through my fourth and fifth step. And, you know, and it was, there's lots of stories attached to that too. I had some problems with that girlfriend of mine. When she found out I got sober, she got pissed off and just was doing whatever she could to, you know, to get me mad and upset my sobriety. So, you know, I couldn't put up with her anymore. I mean, she'd send her daughters by when I'd lock her out. I had to change my phone number 3 times. And finally, after 6 months of that, I was sitting there thinking about how to get rid of her. And it occurred to me that my first wife never bothered me when I was paying her alimony. So I wrote her a letter and I said, If I don't see you or your kids, I'll pay you $150 a month and I'll deduct $25 if I see you, $25 if I see your car, $25 for each of your kids, whoever shows up at the door. And, you know, for 6 months, I bought 6 months of silence and peace and silence. She didn't bother me for 6 months. And then I was strong enough to stop sending the payments and I could stand up to her, but I was pretty weak about that time. You know, before I came up with that idea, I said to myself, God, just give me some kind of a warning whenever she's coming. Now, you won't believe this, but it's true. I used to have my radio on all the time when I was home. And my song for us was Joe Cocker's You Are So Beautiful to Me. And I said, God, just give me some kind of a warning before she shows up and so I can gather myself before I have to confront her. And, you know, every single time that song came on the radio, 5 minutes later, she'd show up. And I never did she show up when that song had not played. So that, for like 3 or 4 months, that became my warning. And every time it came on, I'd say, okay, Shelby's on her way. And lo and behold, 4 or 5 minutes later, she'd show up at my door. Now tell me, God wasn't working in my life. Anyway, I finally, you know, got through that first year. I had made most of my amends. I didn't want to make amends to my children until I was pretty damn sure that this was going to be sobriety was going to be a permanent thing in my life. But I didn't want to eat crow in front of them. So it was probably in my second year of sobriety that I made an attempt to make amends to them. I'm not sure it worked too well, but I did the best I could. But anyway, sobriety since has been a real, you know, I've been through all kinds of things sober. I've worked very hard on building a relationship with God. I've had to confront lots of character defects. I think I've always surmised that the reason God didn't instantly remove all of my character defects was if he did it all at one time, I would have died of shock because the change would have been too great. So the way, in my life at least, I see him working in my life was he dealt with them one at a time, you know, so I wouldn't be overwhelmed by the shock of such a radical change. So, you know, I had to deal with them one at a time, so it took a number of years to get through the whole chain of character defects, and I'm not sure I've been completely purged of them all, but much different than I was when I came in, and pretty happy with his work, the good work he's done in my life, and I call it grace, through the grace of God. I was gonna read my daily thank you list, but there's not enough time. The first thing on the list that concerns my personal life is, you know, I have some things. I thank him in a general way for being the God I believe in. And God, I thank you with all my heart for my sobriety. I thank you for reaching down into my life on July 25th, 1977 and snatching me up out of my active alcoholism and for sitting me down in an AA meeting on July 26, 1977. I thank you with all my heart for Alcoholics Anonymous, the AA program of recovery, and for every single AA meeting I've ever been to. God, you intervened in my life. You restored me to sanity. And through AA, you've got me turned around and headed in the right direction. I can never thank you enough for that. And then the list goes on for two more pages. Now, you know, this all hasn't been a... My sobriety hasn't been a cakewalk. I've had lots of trials and tribulations over the 43 years I've been sober, but, you know, I don't... Maybe some people have gone, you know, danced down the yellow brick road, but that hasn't been my experience. And my thank you list ends up with, and this was one of the first things I put on it before I wrote in all the other things. Yeah, it ends up with God, in addition to everything I've already expressed my thanks for above, I thank you for always being there for me through all the hard times in my life and in my sobriety. When my willpower and self-reliance failed me, you were there. When my marriages failed, you were there. When I lost or left jobs, you were there. When my children decided they didn't want a relationship with me, you were there. When my friendships failed, you were there. When people I loved disappointed me, you were there. When family members, loved ones, and friends passed away, you were there. When my body and my health failed, you were there. When all the money in the world couldn't fix my problems, you were there. When I failed myself, you were there. When I failed those I loved, you were there. And when I failed you, God, you were there for me, even though I failed you. All of these things have happened to me over the course of my life and in my sobriety. You have always been there for me, no matter what. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And, you know, lots of good things have happened. I'm just, you know, all those things that I read, I never could have stayed sober through any of them before I got sober. I would have tried to drink my way through every one of those problems, and since the problems were unending, I probably would have just drank myself to death. But yet, you know, for everything I've been through, I was married and divorced twice in early sobriety, and then decided that maybe I wasn't marriage material. I wasn't going to have any money left over to retire on if I kept giving it away to ex-wives. So I quit getting married. And, you know, I've had to make some other choices like that in my sobriety. But it's just been a learning process for me all along. It's just, in my mind, a miracle that I've lived this long. Heaven's sakes, I even died once in sobriety, seven or eight years ago when I had another heart attack. They had me on the angiogram table, and I came to 18 hours later in the hospital bed, and they were pulling tubes out from every orifice in my body, and three doctors were standing there, and when they got everything pulled out of me, the doctor said, "We're here to tell you that you're lucky to be alive." He said, "You flatlined three times during the angiogram, and we had to go to heroic measures to save your life." So, I've even been dead and resurrected in sobriety. So, anyway, I'm really, really grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, and so glad I got sober. If you're new here, stick around. I don't know of any other way to get sober. If I did, I'd let you know. Anyway, that's all I got. Thanks. Thank you, guys.
Lee, I think you're muted.